they had 11 or 10 rather stages of amplification with 10 extra anodes inside the tube, and bounced the original photoelectron around inside the tube, multiplying, of course, its output to a point where ordinary electronics could produce a very useful signal. Well, this was called the 931A, and when the moment the war was over, the astronomers latched onto it, because one of the problems with astronomy has always been to get precise magnification brightness figures for stars. And so here's this little tube with its sheet telling how good it was, a version that was developed for scientists called the 1P21. And it has an 11-pin base, a collection anode to put out the final signal, and then one could put up to 100 volts across each of the other pins to put that amount of voltage passing the electrons around, bouncing them, and each bounce is all roughly maybe 10, factor of 10 or more increased. A tube that was able to make a quantum efficiency of around 10% compared to, say, the photographic film that we depended on before of about 0.25%. There's one problem. With this tube, when we started looking at the brightness of stars, especially when we were using alternating current methods of amplifying the signal, we discovered stars twinkled. The twinkling showed up very brilliantly in the result. It was hard to figure out what we were going to read. The tube, by the way, plugged into an 11-pin socket like that. These leads would have gone, each of them, to a 90-volt battery or some other means of getting the voltage across the tube. For the balloon flight, we had a little package like this, which converted 12 volts DC to 1,000 volts DC, so ordinary battery juice. And for expedition purposes, I should add, the tube would be embedded. In this case, this is a handheld photometer type of instrument, again, for the same sort of purpose that I was making the balloon flight, the measurement of twinkling of stars. The 1P21 is in the handle, and put in 1,000 volts for the field and take out the signal that we would be processing then in ancillary electronic equipment. The star twinkling. We made it a job at the observatory, a number of us, to try to solve the question of what all that represents. Where especially did it occur in the atmosphere? We sent up artificial stars on balloons carried by helicopters, kites, put them on posts at a distance. We did all sorts of things trying to figure out what was represented by star twinkling, sometimes with a scientific term, scintillation. And there came one day when a chap in naval uniform showed up at our place and said, I understand you've got a problem. We explained it to him. He said, well, I'm in the business of finding good scientific purposes for ballooning, free balloons in space, and maybe I could help you. He said, you certainly could, but what we would like you to do is to observe from above the tropopause. And he said, no problem. I and my colleague have been above the tropopause more than once, even in the open gondola type of balloon flight that I might use for you, since this is not a very high altitude. And then I said, but it's got to be at night. He says, no problem. And so I was driving him back to his office at the Office of Naval Research in town. And on the way, he said, by the way, we've discovered that when the scientist who's concerned with the data goes along and makes the observation, the results tend to be more satisfactory. I said, well, that makes sense. Would you be willing to be that man? Well, about 20 seconds, I said, sure. You know, it wasn't until after the show was really over that I learned that before Malcolm Ross went to work for the Navy as a meteorologist, he was an advertising man in Southern California. I also learned that this was the first time a layman had gone along to make the observations with a professional pilot, and it was also the first time that he'd ever considered going at night. At that point, we might as well get started. We may lights out and start our slides, the ones I've been able to pull out here. And I'll get back so I can face them and try to speak more just from the slides than from my prepared written speech. You look at the guy there with an oxygen mask on his face. He's sitting in the back of the truck, partially dressed for cold weather, and he's breathing pure oxygen in order to purge nitrogen out of his blood because he had had occasion to get the feeling of bends when nitrogen would form bubbles in the blood. He was only supposed to breathe it for about half an hour, but the people who were doing the balloon work were a little slow. Let's see if I've got the right button. Yes. But along with sitting there, he's looking out at kind of a pandemonium like this, with rocky wall at the side and sort of a balloon there, a loud noise from gas going into the balloon, and all these people scurrying around. And hey, an opportunity then, first time in about 4 or 5 months to just sit down and think about what was going on. He had the opportunity to recall how this had gone in those preceding hectic months. This was Malcolm D. Ross, now dead, but he was the chap in charge of the scientific ballooning program. He'd been up to something like 60 or 70,000 feet in the capsule, and with his companion Lee Lewis, he had indeed been in an open gondola to 40,000 feet in the daytime once, and he'd stay there just for a brief time. We were proposing to stay up above the tropopause, you know, that mystical layer where the surface weather of the Earth stops and you enter the stratosphere. And sometimes one can see it from high-flying airplanes in high latitudes in wintertime as a kind of a virtual horizon out the window. Everything below it's murky and everything above is very clear. We were going to get above the tropopause on this flight, mostly because we had a deep suspicion that any star twinkling had to be introduced to starlight below the tropopause rather than above it. The process of getting ready for the flight. There's a personal physical preparation involved, lots of sessions with doctors and tests and things. Giving up a bit of blood off of the ends of my fingers every day for weeks beforehand, and then clothes. We knew that at the tropopause the temperature should be around minus 55 degrees centigrade. And so there's a lovely visit to clothing laboratory operated by the Navy at Natick. And I visited them, and they outfitted me with some inflatable plastic boots that airmen used in the old days when their airplanes were unheated. And then they totally designed clothing that they said would keep me comfortable at the South Pole at 100 below zero Fahrenheit. And so I had all that clothing and gloves and everything and these boots, and there was a question, could we have added heating to our feet and hands to keep ourselves comfortable and mobile? A quick phone call to a chap who had been an Eagle Scout with Admiral Byrd at the Antarctica once upon a time back in the 20s, he immediately said, one thing I can advise, don't heat your extremities. You've got to heat the body core and let the extremities take care of themselves, or you will have very serious effects. So No heat then for extremities. An old-fashioned oxygen mask left over from World War II. Airplanes now were pressurized, so these things were antiques, but they dug it out for us. Okay, we couldn't heat our hands, but we could make a muff to heat the camera that National Geographic loaned us, a nice Leica M3. It had been winterized for cold weather, Antarctic again, but the film that you use isn't winterized. It goes stiff if it gets too cold. So we are going to keep it inside this heated muff, and maybe we would sneak a little warmth through our fingers in between. Here we are, Malcolm Ross and I, going over where we are at the show, and it ends up with us inside a low-pressure chamber. They pump all the air out. You're in there at 150 millibars instead of 1,000. And you have the equipment that you started putting together for the show to see how it enjoys being down at a temperature of minus 55 centigrade. And the other side of this lovely chamber, this one's in the Washington, D.C. area, a little bit of wind is possible to make things feel real. But we had great hopes. There'd be no wind if there was a balloon, free-moving balloon. We test ourselves together as we got farther along with, in this case, the Navy doctor who had an interest using me as, both of us, I guess, as guinea pigs, how we would react to stress and various other things. In the meanwhile, he wanted to make sure we might have a chance of coming out, surviving it. We're standing outside another pressure chamber in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Why there? Because the Navy retained General Mills, the people who make Cheerios, as their balloon flying contractor. So we went to their base there and figured that we would do probably all on Cheerios, but fly out from there. At the same time I was going through this, of course, we began to realize it was becoming a serious expedition. And let's see if I've got the right button. Oh, that's the wrong button. Okay, maybe we'll go that way. One of my colleagues, who happened to be the director of the observatory's branch at Flagstaff, Arizona, mentioned on these previous slides that we were being shown, he came along partly to help me in any way he could, but also hoping at any moment I would say, I'm scared, I'm backing out, and he would put on the clothes and get to go there instead of me. But he was a good aide. But in the meanwhile, we gave him the feeling of what he was like. He said, well, since I'm a smoker, I live at 18,000 feet all the time, and so I'm not having to change much. Then we started assembling at the Navy station there. Here I am. Ah, you're seeing the telescope I'm going to use. How'd they come about? Well, we got talking to Aidan Meinel, who was site testing for the Kitt Peak National Observatory at the time. And he said, oh, I think a catadoptric is the best kind of telescope to use for the purpose. Well, from my point of view, the simplest catadoptric to grab up in a hurry was going to be a Questar. And I knew nothing about it except its fanciful ads in the amateurs' journals. But I went up to New Hope, Pennsylvania, and met Lewis Bramer, the designer and entrepreneur who put this thing on the market, and had a lot of time chatting with him. Turns out he'd spent time at the Naval Observatory in his past. And he made up a Questar Special. The ordinary catalog model had the barrel of it was blue with the map of the stars on it and the map of the moon or something like that on the shade. But we wanted just a plain, hard-working one. And on the back of that thing was going to be fastened one of these 1P21 phototubes with that little voltage supplier connected up to a 12-volt battery. And you see several of them in back there waiting to go aboard. In the meanwhile, they're being connected up with my electronics to see how things are all working right. And there are the conversations you can see, but this gives you the first taste of the gondola. Fiberglass, a seat in the corner for the observer is visible there. the corner adjacent to the corner of the picture would be the seat for the pilot, Malcolm Ross. And in between us would be the navigational equipment of various sorts. The Ross was checking over this gondola from another point of view, oxygen tanks attached to it, and of course there's provision for ballast. A free balloon can stay aloft as long as you have ballast. The ballast that we used was iron ore ground up, sintered by cooking. It looked kind of like sand, but it was about five times as heavy. And we had canisters of it distributed around and presumably electrically controlled valves so we could trip switches. What is hanging from the ceiling for, though, is to be loaded up with scales so we know how much it was going to weigh, especially when Mal Ross and I climbed inside and took our seats. How much was that going to weigh when we were going to send it aloft? So we were fitting it out there in this garage laboratory affair on the Navy base. And ultimately we weigh it, and it weighed, the whole mess was going to weigh about 2,300 pounds. That's just the ballast and two passengers and the gondola and the oxygen and all of the batteries, everything that goes along. Final test of the equipment in the cold chamber, and then you're starting to load up. They labeled these Navy vehicles with red crosses and flashing lights and things, but inside they may have been available to service people, but inside they had a bunch of equipment for tracking purposes and partly for picking up the physiological signals from two passengers. It's part of the doctor's experiment. And just watching where we are, being able to talk to us and vice versa. It was about this point that it was made very clear to me that when we were aloft, we were on our own. There's no way anybody on the ground could bring us down. There, all sorts of things can go wrong in these flights. It can turn out to be impossible to get rid of the gas. You might, it's a little chilly up there and the air is thin. You might go to sleep and you won't wake up until a few weeks later and the gas has leaked out and it comes down ground. So they, you could say, had a purpose. The months of effort, not only, of course, the trips to the clothing people and the trips to New Hope, Pennsylvania for Questars and all the other rambling around. It comes to an end. We're waiting for the weatherman to say, it's safe to go. No jet stream, no storms, wind is the proper direction. It's not likely that you'll have to go across the Atlantic Ocean before you're permitted to come down. It's set to go. So we get going. We drive out to the site that's picked. Why a hole in the ground? Well, for a nighttime observing, Mal Ross says we take off in the afternoon because we don't want to spend too much time in the air. So we'll take off in the afternoon, but in the afternoon there's surface breezes and you can't start setting a balloon above a gondola with wind laying the whole thing flat against the ground. So we go find a convenient hole in the ground near Brainerd, Minnesota, about 80 miles north of Minneapolis, and they get permission to use this old mine there, not currently active, and we assembled up at the top, casing the joint, looking it over. Somehow or other, I was still affecting a business suit on this job. I was trying to act like I wasn't it. But we could look down and see what was ahead of us, an empty hole there, some leaky underground water somehow or another. You can just barely see a bulldozer that we had asked, or General Mills, somebody had asked to be on site to help move heavy vehicles. So here is Art Hoag and one of the naval officers, probably the man in charge. The artifacts up above in the picture represent 50-year-old slides that have been sitting around every which place and grow a little bit of fungus on them. But you can see in the distance there's a truck going down. That's a helium truck. It was the first one to go down to the bottom. And then more things proceeded. There's the regular truck behind holding the gondola and a lot of other things. And you have a better view of what it's all like here and why it's maybe sensible to have a bulldozer there to help push people around and out. The position on the bottom, we've gotten down there. Here's that stream going from one of those ponds to another. The assembly of vehicles, the pickup truck belonged to the bulldozer operator, of course. And then I'm at this stage kind of standing around. Everybody else seems to know what to do. General Mills provided, as I said, the contract launching service, and also the provided they had made within their own shops the particular balloon. Now, the balloon is made out of polyethylene plastic, carefully welded together, these seams, by a lot of ladies in a big gymnasium-type building, I'm told. And the success depends upon how well they did their job. It's cut to a design scientifically created by people at University of Minnesota interested in this business. To have a size so when it's full of helium, it will not want to travel any higher than 40,000 feet with a load of a little over a ton. And the success of the expedition depends on how well they did their job. The balloon itself is inside the pink wrapper here. Lying on top of it is a long tube, which you'll see more of, is the job of filling. The chap on the left was holding ballast within the tray, which he was pouring aboard the cans attached to the gondola. So there are a number of different crews working, the gondola crew representing our crowd, the General Mills crowd unpacking the balloons out of the crates. And I'm still standing there with my hands in my pockets, I think, wondering if this was anything to do with me, I guess. And it starts to get assembled, and pretty soon they tell me, "All right, according to our schedule, it's time to go. Get your clothes." So we used, Ross and I used the truck in there as our dressing room. At the time, we didn't realize we needed to be embarrassed any, but we discovered differently shortly. And General Mills people are doing their part. And from up on this hill, one of my friends was taking the picture of the first gas going into the balloon, making this bubble at the upper end of a balloon that would end up around 80 feet in diameter, I think. And the wrapper was being pulled off as the thing was getting inflated through that long inflation tube. The balloon itself was going to be open at the bottom, so that if it went above the requisite height, being a rigid balloon as they defined the term, meaning the material couldn't stretch, the excess gas would go out and the balloon would lose lift and come back down a bit. And you would have hopes you could settle up there. Here they're getting things straightened out as part of the chore. And the gondola is getting more and more full of stuff. In the back of the truck, I was changing my clothes. More and more stuff got on. The long lead there, so that if we had any trouble landing, we could drape this big hose full of this same ballast material, the sintered iron ore, trail it on the ground, and maybe that would slow us down with the rope to hold it there. One of the things you might ask, well, what are you going to do if trying to rescue yourself was totally up to you? We had parachutes. And part of getting ready meant that I had to learn how to use a parachute. It was pointed out to me, if I go overboard at 40,000 feet, don't pull the ripcord until you're down below 10, preferably 5,000 feet, because if you do, you'll freeze to death before you get to any place. So, now the chap with the shirt here, the plaid shirt, was General Mills' man in charge. And the chap over on the right, I think, is probably my Arthur Hoag, leaving me. But I'm now sitting in the back of the truck, like I showed in that first picture, somewhat lightly dressed, breathing pure oxygen, and watching the comedy going on outside of me. The air, gas hissing through that long hose there, a loud hissing sound. And of course, as the balloon gets filled, it starts going up. And the only thought that went through my mind watching that and listening to the hissing beside the earphones around my ears, I had no trouble hearing it. You know, you hear, read these stories about the old days in England, the convicted man going to be hung in the morning, so he wakes up listening to him nail the scaffolding together. Well, I heard him nailing together with the helium going into that balloon. The let's see, we'll get her. Now the balloon comes within my view and I can directly take pictures of it. There's more excitement, more stuff is being added to it. The the balloon gets more and more full, more and more straight up. They're about to the point where they're going to pull the last of that red sleeve off. You certainly get a view of the rugged terrain that we're going to have there to leave. And by now, they are doing something else. Rather than depending upon personal parachutes, Mal Ross wanted to depend on a big cargo parachute, which would be attached to the bottom of the balloon, and then we would be attached to the bottom of the cargo parachute. If we want to go it on our own, there were a couple of red switches on the control board in the gondola, and when we both flipped those switches, that fired the firecrackers that turned the balloon loose and let us then drift down gracefully and slowly on the parachute. Mille Lacs Lake, a big lake in that part of Minnesota, was roughly in the anticipated routing. No boats were on it ordinarily that time of year, May 8th, till cold, the ice barely off of the lake. So we'd gotten the sheriff to be out there with a boat, figuring that if we had to come down in a hurry, it would be very likely on the lake, and would he please come and rescue us until the Navy could take hold and then bring us out. The balloon itself, you can see, is only partially full. It has all the excess material is kind of draped around, making really sort of a odd plane there. It means that as the balloon goes up, it's going to corkscrew its routing up. Only I didn't know that at the time. But it's not going to be a simple ball of anything rising. It's got all that extra material flapping around there. They're still probably putting stuff in. The point comes, they hang it onto the scale. The scale says it's now got about 2,750 pounds of lift. That means the whole load is 450 pounds light. And Mal Ross said, I want it good and light because I want to get out of that hole in a hurry before we should be blown against the rocky sides or if anything terrible happens to us. We've got to get out of there with a jump. And so we had these extra lift there, and I'm in the process of crawling into my seat on the far corner there, and Val Ross will be coming over on the right-hand corner right next to the man in the plaid shirt, and he'll climb in. It was a circus, as you can see from the number of people around there, and you figure all the vehicles that have come to assemble us there, plus the truck drivers for the helium. Here's our final goodbye farewell picture. Still barehanded, of course. We figure we've got two or three layers of gloves we're going to aim to have, and we've got an outer jacket we're going to aim to have, too, when it counts and is necessary. In the background, you see them finally checking the connection between parachute and balloon. The whole thing still, of course, anchored to the truck, but then he's going to let that loose. And I don't know how they fed it up into position. Somehow or other, I wasn't interested. There was, as I say, one female watching this thing. When I was in the back of the truck, I could see her swinging back and forth on the door, yelling to her father, the bulldozer operator, who was over, whether helping or not, he was at least enjoying the show. "Daddy, Daddy, I want to come over where you are." Well, I didn't need to take off my earphones to know what she was saying. Well, my colleague went to take her picture, and so she promptly went into a proper pose for it, but as soon as he was done, why, it was "Daddy, Daddy" again. And that was perhaps the nicest touch of the whole thing. Above our heads, you can see what looks like plastic. That was our notion of a tent made out of nylar that would come down these four straps that would be carrying the balloon. We figured greenhouse effect and would hold heat and it wouldn't be so cold and we'd be able to work better and things like that. We were wrong. And later on, a physicist, astronomers don't know everything, but a physicist friend of mine explained just why it was a crazy idea at the offset. But we had that for the start, and we crawled in and got rigged up. My colleague to the right there, Art Hoag, and you can see the famous telescope here. And just imagine on the back of the telescope the little 1P21 doing its job to try to do good scientific measurements of star twinkling at all sorts of points up and down on this flight. And then we have to get an antenna for our nighttime observing stuck down through a hole in the bottom of the floor and sticking out 3 or 4 feet below. That meant that a whole gang of guys equal to more than 450 pounds had to hold it down and let the thing bobble around on the ground. I was at this point recalling that some of the stories are that somebody on the ground is hung on to the balloon or gets carried off accidentally. Here the whole gang is around there. And Moss and I haven't put on our outer jackets yet because it's still not that chilly. But we're getting ready to go. And the scene can be seen from the bottom. If one of those guys didn't let go, and it's been known sometimes that a guy holding down the balloon didn't let go, and we went out of there with him carried aloft, the question would be, do you take him to altitude and make him observe right along with you, or do you abort this whole thing that you've gone without sleep for two nights already in a row and all sorts of things to get to this point? Do you abort the whole show just on account of him? Well, fortunately, that decision didn't have to be made. We're clear, nobody's hanging on, but we're sure looking like a peddler's basket loaded with gear. Hanging on the bottom and not yet showing, but you will see it, was going to be the flashing light to tell all airplanes, please don't bump into us at night. The rest of that story is that throughout the whole flight, I never saw an airplane at night. We moved fast. We got up. We were light enough so we moved vertically 20 miles per hour. That was faster than Ross had ever gone aloft by a factor of probably four. It's faster than I'd been prepared for. and it made that Mylar tent rattle like sin. We cleared the place successfully, and this was the last picture they got of us before we really got away. You can see the light hanging. It had its own parachute, and before we landed, we had to make sure, remember, to cut that off again by an electric signal to go. You can see the parachute between the balloon and the gondola, and the balloon itself, not even half full, of course, not by a long shot. Almost immediately, I caught my breath enough to try to take a picture, and for the first time, I hadn't really looked at this road map before. I brought one along here. Anybody that wants to see the surrounding, it's full of lakes and ponds in that area. It is amazing countryside, and I had no notion of where, how much water there was. One of the last pictures, Ross at this stage is figuring we don't need to go quite so fast. He's trying to let off some ballast, but he really didn't affect anything. I was watching the rate of ascent meter, which told how many thousand feet per minute we would be ascending. We were late in getting off, 2 hours later than the schedule called for. So although the scenery and the takeoff looks bright, the sun had actually set for the ground there. And as we rose, of course, the sun rose for us. And so we had to go on up. In the meanwhile, we were in sunlight, and the balloon is beginning to look like it's full up. I think this is probably pretty close to getting to the top, because by this time we've obviously gotten rid of the Mylar tent that was so annoying. I made an effort to get rid of that in a hurry. But as we were going and the air started getting colder, especially rushing by us this way, it dawned on me that we had to get our jackets on, zipped up, closed, had to get those three layers of gloves on our hands. And by the time we had done that, we were essentially at altitude. This wasn't our picture of the balloon, but with a telescope from the ground, and I'm sorry about the fungi artifacts that got stuck on this otherwise nice picture, but the balloon at full altitude looks awfully pretty. And we saw the sun ready to set for the final time, and then it became dark. Now, as we went skedaddling past 35,000 feet, we realized we were going past the tropopause. We saw that beautiful line in every direction. And with not much more, we were there getting in the dark. And this is the last picture I was able to take at night. The stars, of course, came out. This was fantastic. I've never seen so many stars, much more than the certainly the stars only available to somebody at seeing them down to sixth magnitude of the ordinary bright star catalog. I couldn't easily recognize the old familiar constellations. Well, of course, the Big Dipper and Cassiopeia, no sweat. But all the other things, they were confused by the multiplicity of stars. Now, how did the observing go? Well, that's the tough point. It turns out that the balloon was swinging around from side to side, twisting and untwisting the shrouds, because they'd gotten twisted up. And that basket had a lot of inertia in all of the things added to it. Never before had Ross taken one of these open gondolas up with any load at all, and here we had a ton of it, and all of it outside on the perimeter, making a wonderful torsion pendulum. So we were turning around much too fast to begin to aim and hold the aim of the telescope on a star. We were going to have to depend on other things to satisfy other observations, to satisfy what we might see. I had hopes, however, that as we were coming down, our program called for stopping on the way down and taking measurements, and that maybe it would be more steady. The Ross, in his experience, had never gone up with all of this furfurlaw or so fast, and he claimed he had never had them spinning like that. He thought they were real steady riding, and it would be easy to point a telescope. Of course, there was another little problem relating to the layman aboard. I developed what they call abdominal bends. That's all of the spaces within the stomach wherever there's a particle of gas. When you go from 1,000 millibars to 150, these gases expand, just like the gas was expanding the balloon over our heads. And that makes it hard to bend over and do a lot of things. And in particular, the straps of my personal parachute were a nuisance. I unhooked them, and I came within an ace of just taking the damn parachute off. And then I wondered, if I needed it, would I be able to hook an arm through the belting and hang on for a descent of a few thousand feet? I just wondered. And common sense prevailed. I didn't take it off. But it would have been hard to observe, even if the balloon had been steady at that rate. There was a moment I had to scramble. We needed to dump ballast to help keep it there or stabilize it at the ceiling that we built the balloon for. And that turned out the ballast was frozen inside the cans of ballast. So I had to get over there, leaning over, taking cupful by cupful of the top of the ballast can and tossing it over to lighten the load a little bit. At the time I was doing that, we were right over Minneapolis, which was brightly lit all underneath us, a mere 7.5 or 8 miles away, a beautiful sight underneath us, and we were chasing along. In the course of the night, we got speeds up to 65 miles per hour without even the jet stream being noted in the area. After about an hour or an hour and a half, we had to wait for the sun to set and the stars to all get out, and then a lot of attempting to use the equipment and do something. But Ross was obviously getting nervous. It turns out he had in his background more stories of people going to sleep at 40,000 feet and not quite waking up. We had agreed ahead of time that either of us became comatose, we would punch the red button and get the heck out of there in a hurry. But if we'd been depending on the cargo parachute with those shrouds all twisted up, uh-uh. But anyway, I said, okay, Al, let's go down. We've done all we can do. We were about an hour up there, and we were cold. When we went through the tropopause, the cold struck. I had never been so cold, and it went through this Antarctic clothing as if it were nothing, and I knew something was a mistake in the computations. I found out why later. But it was impressive. We were cold, there's no question. And that worried Mal also. So we came on down. Well, the original program said, we'll stop at the tropopause, 35,000 feet, and make some measurements there. So he started dropping ballast to see if we should stop. And I looked at the equipment, and there was an inch of hoarfrost all over everything. The tropopause, of course, is an enormous moisture trap. And when that supercooled rig came down to the relatively warm tropopause, it was only 55. It turned out we were closer to 70 below at 40,000. Why, this frost just developed everything. I tried to push it away, and it was hopeless. Eyepiece was frosted. The objective was frosted. Everything was frosted. Okay, Mal, take it down. Then came the wonderful scientific observation of the show that paid for that. Up above the tropopause, I'd been, of course, looking at all the stars, bright ones especially are familiar, and nothing was twinkling. Ordinarily, you get a star within 30, especially a bright star, within 30 degrees of the horizon, you know, it twinkles with color scintillation, red, green, so on. nothing was twinkling. These star images were absolutely steady, except for any star that was below our true horizon, right down next to the apparent horizon, the tropopause horizon, that we were a mile above. And those stars did indeed twinkle, but above us, from our level up, nothing was twinkling. But now as we descended, going right on down gently, not too fast, I watched the stars start to twinkle, first at the horizon, then slowly on up. And by the time we got to around 14,000 feet, where we discovered a lovely local inversion that we were able to park the balloon on and spend the rest of the night. He wasn't going to land this thing in the dark. Spent the rest of the night parked right against that. And there the temperature was a mere torrid 15 Fahrenheit, 15 degrees. And we took off gears. You can see here, now Ross got his cigarette in. I broke out the lunch that they'd supplied us. First, of course, we looked at the coffee. We specified, make sure that the thermos bottle has a screw top. Well, they'd only thought of it at just before meeting us at the mine. So at the drugstore that gave them these baker's white bread with a couple of slabs of cheese for sandwiches, the only thermos bottle had cork. They filled it with coffee, but of course, when we came back down to 15,000 feet, why, coffee was all on the floor of the gondola, solid, naturally, and mixed with the dirt off of our shoes. And the sandwiches, believe me, they weren't leather, naturally, frozen solid. They weren't worth breaking one's teeth on them. So Mal enjoyed his cigarette, and then he went to sleep. He hadn't had any more sleep in the previous night than I, but the thing was far more novel for me. And I was just watching, identifying stars, watching them rise and set. The only person probably to see the aurora that night from where we were. And no other airplane, as I said, was visible to us. And then when it came later in time to wake up, I said, okay, here we are. You can see we followed the Mississippi River all that night. It was fun. Anytime I looked over the side, there someplace was the river shining back at us. And here it was in the morning. We're still up there at that fairly high level. And that's about as pretty as he felt like looking, I guess, at that time. And, we got lower looking there. And of course, that wasn't the Mississippi. Now, by that time, we had left the river off to the right there, and we were being traced. The doctor, the acting doctor, the younger doctor, was following us with a helicopter and provided this picture of our whole affair. The gondola barely shows up, but we're coming down, obviously getting pretty close to it. The sun hasn't risen down below. It's fun to be coasting along 3 miles up in the air over the waking up countryside. You'd hear screen doors slam, mothers calling to the kids to feed the chickens, and things like that, not knowing that somebody was listening in on them from 3 miles above. We got, by now we're obviously getting pretty down. I might say that we went past Dubuque. For a little while, our expedition people were having trouble keeping up with us, with the vehicles, and we had to guide them when we went by Dubuque, Iowa. We let them know where we were. By the time we're here, a couple hundred feet up now, needless to say, we've gotten rid of the flashing light underneath us. We turned it loose to the landscape sometime earlier so it wouldn't be tangled with us. And here's our crew there in the back driving along, catching up with us. They're the ones that had the hard time. They had to be driving traffic. And as I say, 65 miles an hour sometimes. We're coming in and looking at the landscape. This landscape looked to me like it was solely covered with high-powered electric lines or big trees. I just couldn't see where we were going to land. But Ross said, well, here looks like a good field coming up. And we aimed for it, but we couldn't get down there fast enough. It didn't respond as fast as he said it should when he was letting off gas. So we dumped some ballast, leaked over those trees, and landed in the farmer's yard. And the instant we landed, we were both scared of being dragged by the wind. So he hit the red button and nothing happened. Then I remembered I hit it. There was a bang, and down onto our heads came that enormous parachute all around us. And somebody grabbed this picture of our unloaded balloon taking off, never to be heard from again. Usually they could be found and end up on the farmer's hayrick. And there was an award of $300 to return the big bow top to whoever found this assembly. Turned around once we got clear of the parachute. Here's one of our crewmen there who had been able to cut across lots and get there. And the farmer into whose backyard we had landed. Standing there, pretty soon he was accompanied by his hired hand. Both of them standing there just looking like models for a famous picture of the farm couple, the Midwestern farm couple. And they stayed there all the time. Mal Ross and I stripped off our dirty clothes and et cetera, put on traveling clothes, and looked to rescuing the important things, rescuing the Questar and any other important things, while the Navy people had to finished taking it apart, and I'm told they recompensed the farmer for destroying his local crops and fields. And I at least felt related, and I think Mel Ross did likewise, that we had done this thing, these 5 months of preparation on my part, and the excitement for him on his part, and we had made it, and we were ready to go. We had the first helicopter ride into the Dubuque Airport, south of Dubuque, you can tell from the maps. And then there I got to the airport bathroom. For some weird reason, we never thought, neither Ross nor I discussed this matter of the most serious personal needs. But so from being in the restaurant, maybe in the early lunchtime at Brainerd, the noontime the day before until here about 8 o'clock and 9 o'clock in the morning, we had no provision to how you get inside of all those fancy clothes if you needed to in a hurry, especially when the outside air temperature was 65 below. But General Mills representative there leaning forward to get my debriefing in a hurry, I said, you know, this was a beautiful job. You certainly did a wonderful thing. But about the, let me tell you about coffee and drugstore sandwiches. Anyway, from Dubuque, we were flown back to Minneapolis, and I think finally I was able to get a meal, and finally to get a meal at which I could enjoy the greens and other things, which might add more gas to one's lower intestinal tract. I didn't have to worry about so much. What are the other things? Well, the clothing. I called up Natick and I said, fellas, your costume was a bust. And they said, have you got any suggestion? And I said, yes. I have discovered that they've done a lot of research on the upper atmosphere, and a black body located at 40,000 feet, it's going to radiate heat out to outer space, where the temperature, of course, is only 2.7 degrees absolute. It's going to radiate out to there, and it's going to get cold. I said, have you ever figured what the surface of that costume is? He said, we'll look into it. And later on, he called back. Okay, that costume is 95% of being a black body. We have redesigned the whole thing, coating shiny metal on it, and we now have it only 5% of the black body, And in fact, we tried it out. We sent some of those costumes down to the guys who have to observe from conning towers on submarines, and they reported back. They said, "Man, finally you've given some clothes that are comfortable in the conning tower." He says, "I would never have thought it there. Down here at surface level, how could they be radiating heat so badly?" But anyway, it was a revolution for the costume business in the Navy. Oh, what else? Well, at the altitude, we had one other interesting test. We released a smoke bomb and watched a cloud of smoke. Now, the cloud of smoke should have been moving right along with us, but it didn't. It drifted back at the rate of about 2 meters per second. This meant that between what the balloon was traveling, and we were probably traveling the same speed as the balloon, and where we were, about maybe 150 feet below the center of the balloon, there was a shear in the winds. So that there are wind shears even up there above the tropopause, which might produce air turbulence. On the other hand, the air probably isn't dense enough to have much effect on starlight. We learned a lot of other things. I think that's enough for the show. Thank you for the slides. If you will please turn off the projector and give us house lights. And living witness, you can survive. Bunch of things I learned. Of course, I became an expert, traveled around a lot. One of the finest things was to be able to meet Jacques Cousteau, who had on one occasion with his wife back in about 1932 or 3, gone up inside a gondola with the hydrogen-filled balloon. And I had a wonderful evening with them, and they shared all sorts of stories of all the things that can go wrong with these things. And the most obvious thing, and I watched it happen on some other flights that I was observing, that beautifully made polyethylene balloon will suddenly, without any warning, just split right down the middle. And there you are. Now, if it splits when you're only maybe 500 feet above ground, there's no time or room for parachutes to do anything for you, and you've had it. The old fabric balloons, and the fabric balloons that are used for hot air balloons nowadays, the fabric in the first place is much tougher. In the second place, if it does begin to split, then, as Cousteau said, you kind of parachute down at a comfortable, well, uncomfortable, but relatively safe descent speed with that pieces of balloon serving that as an impromptu parachute. Well, you don't get that with these polyethylene things. The most famous one of my knowledge, a friend of mine was in charge of, the Air Force had this gondola closed capsule balloon being carried by a very high altitude balloon, but the balloon only got up to maybe about 60,000 feet before it burst, and then the whole thing came down fast again, of course, because the shrouds had twisted on the parachute and didn't do them any good. And it hit in the Sierra Mountains, it hit the top of a tall tree and just slid right on down the tree. It was a tree sticking through the thing. And I asked my friend, I said, "Well, when you opened up the capsule, what'd you find?" He said, "Jam-packed with toothpicks." And I said, "Well, have you got a picture of it I could have?" "No," he said. So I have to take his word for it. But nobody was riding in those flights. The Air Force tried to send a number of them up, and they had them just fail one after another. Mal Ross made more flights after May. His most tragic one, none of them, he said, was as successful as the one he did with me. This was one where everything somehow or other worked. The balloon was perfect, lit right, and landing in early morning, no breezes to drag you around. It was just a joy for him. He said his last flight, really, he was taking a doctor as his layman passenger scientist along, and they were equipped with spacesuits, and they went in this free balloon open basket deal to 105,000 feet. And they came down successfully. They planned to land in the sea. Some ships were planned to be there with them. The ships were there. And somebody flying a helicopter around said, "Oh, look, those guys, they're out there floating in the water next to that thing. We got to rescue them." So they came running over, and the helicopter dropped a ring, and Ross was able to get in it, and they picked him up and landed him over on the deck of the ship and said, "Look how smart we were. We rescued your flyers, and you didn't need to take a boat over to them after all." But the doctor was a bigger man than Ross, and he had been losing less sleep. He had been using his body for experiments. And he, of course, had suffered the same kind of excitement I had. And when they dropped a ring for him, he found he couldn't easily fit inside it. He tried to hook his arm over, and they jerked him up. And he fell back in amongst the shrouds of the parachute with the spacesuit, which promptly loaded up with water and sank. And I was privileged to stand alongside the grave at Arlington. But as I say, that was Ross's, as far as I know, his last flight. But as I say, mine was pleasant. And a week or two later, I was at lunch with Al Ross and his sidekick, Lee Lewis, and I was waxing a little bit enthusiastic about what fun it had been, or what joys, and Lee Lewis stops me with a grip and looks me in the face, and he says, "Lonely, wasn't it?" Yes.
We're going to take like about a 3 or 4 to 5 minute break and get Jerry set up for his program on Comet. So if you need to go use the restrooms or stretch your legs for a minute, feel free to. Or we could go one out.
And your white horse is sitting up way off. Well, Mal Ross
put it on there. Go ahead.
That was mine. Oh, yours is way off.
And then above the cloud line, you can see stars, and in the stars it has my name
and the laser pointer.
Oh!
It's
you must just need to sign yourself.
I am. And he said, you know, he's my favorite picture of my
team.
Never come up to me. I guess he's just waiting for you.